Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Hey, Viet, thank you so much for getting back on the podcast. I think we're in just a strange time, and I'm confused. I just don't know anymore. And I understand the simplicity of this first question, but it's simple, but I'm expecting a complex answer from you. To you or to me, is this the darkest place we've ever seen this country, or we haven't seen nothing yet?
I think it depends on who you ask and what kind of history we're discussing. When we say, is this the darkest place in our country's history? It probably is for white people. For other people, maybe not. You know, I think if you've been subjected to genocide or to enslavement, things have probably been worse, undoubtedly. So it's a kind of a selective memory on the part of some people who are commenting about this. I think we have to stress that there is this vast historical and experiential difference depending on who you are as a population. But the current crisis that we find ourselves in is, I think, completely related to enslavement and to genocide. Now, these are aspects of American history that are fundamental to American history, but which many Americans would rather deny, or if they do acknowledge it, would want to simply say, well, that was just, you know, an unfortunate part of our past. But in fact, it's not just a part of our past, but enslavement, genocide, colonization, warfare has made America what it is today. Donald Trump and his supporters embody that. They want a return of the United States to a time period when white supremacists, white nationalists, white Christian power was unchecked. That's what we're witnessing. And so it's not new in American history, but it is being directed now against a lot of white people, which means that the amplification of our crisis feels much greater because of that experience by white people.
Wait, you said it's being directed at white people now? Is that what you said?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. The first targets are definitely Palestinians, their advocates, brown people, anybody who advocates for Gaza or for Palestine. That would include anti-Zionist Jews. But make no mistake, I think white people are also feeling targeted, right? That's because, you know, in Donald Trump's agenda, it's not simply that he's going to go after undocumented people or pro-Palestinians or Venezuelan gangsters. These are simply the first test cases, but the infringement of our civil liberties and supposedly fundamental principles of American principles of free speech, that's going to be felt by white Americans. And of course, white Americans already feel threatened by potential cuts to Social Security or to USAID or what Elon Musk represents and so on. So I think there's clearly a sense that white people are affected by this crisis as well.
And it doesn't seem like it's getting better. You know, I just been thinking about it so much, and I'm right square in the middle with family and close friends that are Trump supporters, and I have friends on the progressive side, the liberals, that are very close friends and family. It makes me paralyzed to communicate anymore. I'm so confused. I don't know which way to go. What is a way to kind of figure out a true north? I mean, when I see thousands of people in Gaza dying, there's no other way to look at this. The things that Trump's been doing in the administration, you take $400 million away from Colombia, make them go a certain route, everybody can speak up and they give in. These tactics that have not been seen ever before in the United States, where does that leave us as just the general population? What do we do?
Seems like you've answered your own question, Ken. Yes, of course. I mean, if you feel yourself caught in the middle of a divide because your families and friends and professional colleagues and so on might be divided, that's not a reason to not say something or not to have an opinion. Of course, I can see situations where, you know, I think we as Vietnamese people are used to this. Everybody stays silent so that everybody can be harmonious. Now, if that's a situation, then there's a right to stay silent. But if you're in an environment in which people are actively saying, hey, I support Donald Trump, I support the agenda that's taking place, I think it is, in fact, our obligation, whether it's in a personal capacity as a relative or a friend, or a professional capacity as a writer, professor, or podcaster with a platform, to actually assert our opinions. And it's simply an obligation, especially if we have such kind of a public platform. So to me, it's actually very, very straightforward. I can see the distinction between trying to negotiate harmoniously one's personal relationships versus taking a public stance. I do that all the time. Like, I'm not a confrontational person in person, but I'm a very confrontational person online, yep, or in my publications and so on. So if you need to make that sort of compartmentalization to make your personal life work while you carry out your professional obligations, I think that's fine. Now, if your friends and colleagues who disagree with you watch your podcast and hear your opinion that differs from them and then take you up on it, that's different. I mean, then that conversation needs to take place. But, you know, I think especially for those of us who have any kind of public presence or opinion, I think we do have to take a stand. Many people are afraid to take a stand on Palestine or in Gaza, or are deeply confused, have been subjected to a lot of pro-Zionist propaganda. I get that too. But the whole other host of issues around civil liberties, around social welfare, all these kinds of things that are core to a certain set of Americans that we count ourselves among, I think that's very clear cut in terms of what needs to be said and done.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some really tough conversations in the last few months, and I do feel taken out of certain circles. I do feel certain guests won't come back on the podcast as a result of the positions that I've taken, both privately and publicly. And I don't want to alienate anybody. I'm here to build. I want to unify our community and what, you know, but oftentimes when I'm talking to family or close friends that are Trump supporters, the issue is they don't understand the issues. And that's a big thing. It's like, how do you explain what is really going on when they're like, oh, that's fake news, or there's no comprehension of the more complex, nuanced conversations?
Well, I think that that's painful. It's one thing to have those kinds of conversations in private, as many people do. I think that with a podcast, you actually have the opportunity to invite some of these people on. I've seen the evidence of this, you know, uninformed people being interviewed on podcasts, or possibly informed people who are deeply conservative, that you can have a conversation with. Doesn't mean you have to be friends with them or can continue to be friends with them. But in fact, this is an opportunity, I hope, for you to have these uncomfortable conversations with people in your circle who may hold contradictory opinions. And if, in fact, you lose friends or opportunities, I've been there as well. I'm sure I've lost opportunities I'm not even aware of because people won't ask me to do certain things. But what's actually kind of interesting is that I've had other opportunities open up, other alliances open up. So it is a difficult moment in terms of possibly shedding some older former self, shedding some relationships with people who are not the people you thought they were, or maybe they are the people you thought they were and you have changed. But many of us are facing these same kinds of momentous decisions. And of course, to lose a personal relationship is something to feel sad about, but I'm not necessarily sure it's something to regret if you have changed and they have changed.
Yeah,
these circumstances have revealed that you're actually much more different than you thought you were.
And, you know, I don't want politics to divide us. You know, I've always been that way, but now we're at a crossroads in society that we have to accept that we are being divided. And I can't help but think that America in the 50s or 60s, what were one society, it's homogeneous and it was a little bit more peaceful. But now that we have technology, we have social media, we have so many different viewpoints. And now we just see the fabric of society sort of crumbling. That's the feeling that I get. We can see it clearly where there's no more ability to talk with each other and to hear each other. We're all in an echo chamber as well.
I disagree. You cited the 1950s. Let's look at that. This is the decade that Americans like to think nice liberal warm feelings about. Wow, that was civil rights. That was desegregation. How could anybody be opposed to these kinds of things? We're all united on that. In fact, of course, if you go back, people were being murdered, right? The KKK was bombing churches, killing little girls, murdering civil rights workers, murdering reverends, murdering black people and white people and Jewish people. It was an incredibly violent time. And it was a very clear decision that had to be made. So just project yourself back into the circumstances, and you're saying now, well, I don't know what to do. You know, there's good people on both sides. And you go back to that era, I'm sure a lot of the the pro-segregationists thought they were good people too. It doesn't matter. You know, if your personal and political conviction is this, and these other people are over there, you think morality is on your side, as well as, you know, other things like the life of our civil society, the choice is pretty clear. It's painful, like I said, but it was also very painful in the 1950s. And actually, at this point, probably more painful in the 1950s in some ways, because we are not quite yet at the stage of violent crackdowns or murders at night at the same scale with happening, I think, in the 1950s. It could happen. I think it could happen. And that's definitely reason to be worried and to be scared. But again, it's one thing to praise the accomplishments of the past and think that we all agreed on that, but then to look back and to realize that no, there was a very large portion of the American population that were actively, even violently resisting the kinds of social changes that we on our side, or on, you know, a large part of the of well-meaning American side right now, would think no one should have opposed those things. So it's always difficult to live through moments of political conflict. And unfortunately, that's the moment that we now have.
Yeah. And I'm feeling sort of the growing pains of being more politically awake and vocal about the ways I'm processing this information. I just, out of my character, I just want to be a peacemaker, and I just want to have fun dialogue and, you know, get to learn a few things about the people that come onto the podcast. But there is a line in the sand that's starting to happen in my mind. I'm starting to see it. I'm starting to feel it. I can't. That's why I reached out to you, and I'm like, we have to have a discussion. But when I see stuff like Gaza and the atrocity that happens without any repercussions, I feel helpless, and I feel like I need to be vocal. But I also feel like, what recourse do regular people like us have other than speaking up? But I mean, there's a lot of people that are speaking up, but the social media sort of algorithms are putting us all in echo chambers. But what can we really do as a citizen of the United States?
In your capacity as a podcaster and as someone who has a lot of connections and so on, I think you have a great opportunity. You know, I think that you don't have to just talk to me. You can talk to people who disagree with you, you disagree with them, or you're all equally caught in some kind of, you know, agony about what to do and what future to choose. Those kinds of conversations carried out in public, those dialogues that are face-to-face, even if virtually, I think are actually very important. So you've already got this setup taking place. I'd encourage you to deploy that and work through some of these things in front of people. Not necessarily that you would agree, but at least to have a conversations would be really crucial. I think that sense of isolation and despair that you are talking about is obviously very common. We feel atomized, we feel individualized, we don't see our leaders taking action. Now, certainly Trump and his administration and the people he's appointed, they're taking action. But university presidents, our Democratic leaders are not really leading the way we want them to. And so I think
I agree with you. They're not leading the way we want them to. But what recourse do they have? What recourse do they have when their funding is being challenged? And, you know, big numbers like $400 million is being thrown out the window unless you, you know, kneel in front of the king.
Right now, there are students suing the Trump administration for our argument that they're being threatened with illegal deportation. So there's students, university students suing. Columbia University won't sue. Paul Weiss, a law firm, won't sue. So in fact, they are demonstrating a tremendous degree of cowardice in the face of these threats, and yet these students are not. the students recognize this is a life and death situation for them. Columbia University and Paul Weiss and everything that they, all the other firms and universities and so on that are like them should recognize this is a life and death situation. It's not simply a matter of pragmatic survival of your budget and so on. So in fact, I think we have evidence of these kinds of actions, acts of resistance taking place. In terms of answering your question, I would say, I think the American people, many of them are in a state of shock. They've expected their democratic institutions to work. And so far they're not really working too well, except for some of the courts. I think once the shock wears off and once people realize that these institutions and leaders that we have trusted and believed in may not function very well, hopefully we'll see more mass mobilization in the streets. And this is a hard point to get across to Americans. Maybe we've had too much of faith in our systems, and people in other countries may not. And so they know they should take to the streets in order to fight. We have, you know, and we need to see those numbers. Even President Obama said, I need people in the streets in order to give me political cover and motivation to do my work. Whether he actually did that is another question. But I think, you know, in fact, you know, for those of us who are Democrats, reluctantly or otherwise, or independents, I think we do need to actually show political pressure, not on Trump and his administration necessarily, because they're not going to listen, but on the Democratic Party to actually do something, to actually take a stand when they're able to. We hope, of course, that there will be a change in the midterm elections and the Democrats will have a little more power. But if they continue to do what they do now, then, of course, we're in even more trouble. So the way to get out of feeling isolated is to, number one, have face-to-face dialogues, find your community, get out in the street. Don't think about changing the entire country. Think about finding your community and mobilizing with them to give you a sense of solidarity on a small scale. And a lot of those kinds of actions lead to big actions. That's my most hopeful assessment of what we can do.
Speaking of scaling, when you think about the students who are suing versus a big organization like Columbia, you can make an argument that the students don't have a whole lot to lose. They don't have much. But when you think about the cowardice of a big university, and this is happening, I'm sure, all across the nation, the people who are in charge have a lot more to lose, or they're thinking and they're making this calculation that there's a lot more at stake for many more people when they make decisions like standing up to the government. So there's that sort of like that scale of like, okay, I'm just one student. I'm going to go sue the government for me. And the big university president and the board has to make decisions that will affect thousands of lives, both students and teachers and administrative people.
Yeah, I don't envy these people. But on the other hand, they've asked to do this. They spent their entire careers performing a certain kind of professional persona and doing certain kinds of professional things and saying certain kinds of things that we should all believe in, like, you know, the ideals of the university and Western civilization and all of that. And here is a very clear test case of those ideals. But instead of standing up for the ideals, they retreat to a pragmatic argument. And I get it, exactly what you're describing. Maybe people will lose jobs, et cetera. Big chunks of the university will be eviscerated. But maybe that's what actually needs to take place. In order to save the university, you have to be willing to sacrifice certain parts of it at this particular moment. I don't know if anybody's having that conversation. It's simply that, well, we need to survive and protect what we have. But if we protect what we have on the terms that the administration has given us, I think it actually does, in effect, eviscerate the university already. And the university will not be able to do the things that the university presidents have always said we should be doing. Pursuit of knowledge, justice, truth, all those kinds of things, that's all going to go away.
Now, I know that you are almost at the end of your teaching time at USC. Are you on your last year or your next year is your last year?
I think next year will be my last year.
So next year being your last year, do you feel more empowered to speak out because it's almost time to leave? Do you not really care? Even if you had 5-10 more years left?
I don't really care about the consequences of speaking out within a university. I just want more time. You know, to be a university professor means you have many obligations. Yeah. And you don't have to get into that. But But it's mostly for me, I think each of us has to recognize the talent that we have and what we can do with it. And to recognize that we have a certain amount of time to carry this out. I'm a writer, and that's my one talent, I think. And I just need to maximize that. And so that's crucial, especially in a time of crisis. I think you're feeling this right now. We have to recognize what we can do in our own way and figure out how to maximize that. And for me, it's freeing up my time from not teaching and doing administrative work and so on to focus on the writing. And I think writing matters.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I think each of us, when we think, oh, does podcasting matter? Does writing matter? Does this matter? Does that matter? We all feel isolated and unsure and so on. But in fact, we each have to believe that the one thing we can do, we should do it really well in the cause of what we believe in. And if enough people do that, then in fact, we can actually collectively do something.
But while you're in the university space, do you feel like you are one of the few outspoken people, or do you feel like a lot of you are outspoken and you are empowered to speak out without any consequences?
Well, I can't really speak about my colleagues, my fellow colleagues and so on. I think there are a small number of the faculty at USC, for example, who are pretty vocal, but it's an extremely small number. And I think that's actually more typical than not. I don't know if that university professors have ever been collectively advocates. Most of them would just want to do their work. And I get it, but it is frustrating to see that taking place, especially in such a moment of crisis where the entire university is threatened. You would hope more faculty would recognize that the entire mission of what they do is at stake, and not simply some random political cause that they don't comprehend. So that's depressing. I'm not sure I want to be around that, honestly. So, I've been around academia long enough to know that the advocates have actually always been in the minority, regardless of what the Trump administration says, that universities are full of Marxists and the like. It's simply not true. Most people are conformists and they want to do their job really well. And there's not necessarily a problem with that. But seeking safety in conformity is not going to work in this current situation.
But I think that's a nationwide issue. I don't think that it's just a university-wide issue, that idea of conformity, because I mean, secretly, I'm just hoping this all blows away and we just wake up in a few more years and the pendulum will swing. Somebody like Obama would take over. I mean, Obama was not perfect, but I mean, he's on the other extreme where it felt good for 8 years. I did feel really good when he was when he was the president. And it's optics. It's just the way we feel. And I think that when I think about the emotions that I'm feeling inside watching this whole thing go down, and the way this bullying from Zelensky to the way Colombia turned out. I mean, every day that there is the headlines that I'm reading is some situation that this president is just strong arming, and it's just like trickling down to everything in the environment, and it just feels hopeless.
I think, I agree. I take what little solace I can in thinking that what is being revealed is the distinction between soft power and hard power. And for many Americans, they could always take comfort in not having to confront the hard power dimensions of the United States, because they could turn to the soft power instead, Obama's nice manners and pleasant persona and all this kind of thing. But, Obama was also, of course, authorizing drone strikes, expanding executive power, all these kinds of things, and deporting people on a greater scale. Mm-hmm. So all these things were actually taking place. But because he was a nice guy, a certain portion of the American population who voted for him could ignore that.
Yeah, it was, Trump optics. It's just optics.
But optics are a part of the power, right? And so we were seeing a shift where now Americans as a whole, and not just some of its minority populations, are being forced to confront the fact that American power is at its core really violent, really violent. So it's a shock, right? Like, okay, well, we invade Central America. That's too bad. But invading Canada, off limits. Why? There's actually no reason why there should be any distinction between our degree of offense about these things, except Canada is like a white country or dominated by white people. That's off limits. We're Western Europe, off limits. But he's only threatening to do to these countries what the United States has historically done to its minority populations and to non-white countries. So the only positive hope out of that is that perhaps more people will recognize this is what America actually really is.
So what you're saying, it's not even a Trump thing. It's really the unmasking of how horrific American power is. And we're just now seeing the engine, we're seeing the mechanics of it on the inside now.
So exactly, who's the we, as we started our conversation with, right? If you've been on the receiving end coming from a colonized country or a country that the United States has interfered with on a regular basis, like everything south of the American border or in the Caribbean, then perhaps none of this is really that new, still very unpleasant, but not that new. But again, I think for a certain portion of the American population that we are calling we, white people and white adjacent people who benefited from the operations of American power, yes, it is shocking to see how what's at the core of that power.
You think any of this is reversible? You think we'll ever go back to something a little bit more benign?
That I don't know. Of course, I would hope so, but I have no idea what the future is going to portend. As you said, I think many people have faith in the system that democracy will work, that somehow some invisible people somewhere are doing the jobs they're supposed to be doing and are going to steer us back to where we thought we should be. But if everybody believes that and nobody does anything or not enough people do something, then I think the future looks pretty bleak. So that's why I do think that, in fact, mass public demonstrations of opposition are really crucial, because that's visible evidence that there are many people out there who are upset and are willing to do something about it. So again, we have not quite reached that stage. We're seeing some of these protests around Elon Musk and Tesla and some other protests in certain parts of American cities and so on, but still haven't perhaps reached quite the mass where no one can ignore that. And I think that's where my faith is invested. If we can see that, then we can see that American democracy can save itself because large numbers of the American people are actually willing to do something about it.
You know, I had this question about what is the silver lining that we could possibly take away from this right now? But I think one of the things that I'm hearing from you is we've peeled the mask off. We can see clearly now what the agendas are. But do you have a silver lining that, you know, through all this chaos and mess, is there a silver lining in all this?
Is there a silver lining? Well, I think the silver lining is if, in fact, more Americans realize that democracy is what we make out of it, the better. I mean, for many Americans, democracy is possibly voting, expressing yourself on social media. That's about the extent of it. And now we have a test, and that's the silver lining. Here's the test. Do you believe in democracy? Do you believe in these rights? Do you believe in the Constitution? All these kinds of things. And are you willing to at least get out there on the streets and do something about it? Are you willing to actually do more than simply tweet, but also do whatever it is that you yourself are good at? That's the silver lining.
Now, something that has been really creeping in my mind is there's a lot of people who are being rounded up, the felons, the people formerly incarcerated or were incarcerated, being sent back to their country. And you see now visas being revoked because of their disagreement with the Trump administration, and they're getting sent back or they're not let back in the country. But do you ever think that 1942 internment camps can happen to people like us who are vocal about what we're seeing and we're challenging it?
I think so. I think we have to remember that in 1942, when the Japanese Americans were sent off, they were a very marginalized population. No Asian American movement there, nothing like that. Very small population as well, 120,000 people on the West Coast. So this is where it starts, selectively targeting very small populations that are not well understood, who don't have advocates for them, and so on. So yes, we started, or not we, but the Trump administration has started with supposed gangsters from Venezuela, with undocumented migrants, and the like. There's no doubt in my mind that the kinds of camps and cages that have already been set up to handle people like that could easily be applied to anybody who's labeled a political subversive. And so we see those test cases already with students who are pro-Palestinian, who've done nothing more in some cases than simply write an editorial in their college newspaper saying this is wrong.
Or a like on a social media page.
And they're being deported or have, you know, I hate this term, self-deported, you know, so that they can avoid the possibility of being sent into a detention center and not be found for a long time. So these are university students. These are not gangsters, right? And so the line from that, from a university student who is an international student to people who are academics or people who speak out, who could be labeled under Marco Rubio's idea, you know, supporters of a foreign adversary simply because they don't agree with an American war. That's a very, very thin line.
I'm going to make a hard pivot to a day that's very near and dear to both of us. April 30. I've avoided calling it anything. You know, it's just, there's no reason to call it. And I've been challenged, you know, privately for not taking a stand on what to call 4:30 other than 4:30. And the day is coming up and people are asking me, are you going to any of the events, the commemorations, the mourning, the celebration, whatever the words are, people are asking me. And I'm saying that no. I'm trying to internalize all this and I'm kind of hiding and I'm avoiding making appearances or showing up because it's not in line with really how I feel, not in Vietnam and not in America. I just find myself in this weird, I wish I could just go back to Fort Indian Town Gap and crawl back into my mom. You know, it's like, I'm trying to figure that out. How do you feel about this 50th coming up?
Oh, I'm sick and tired of it.
you and I both.
You know, the Sympathizer, the novel I'm best known for, came out in 2015. That was the 40th anniversary. I talk constantly about 4:30 or whatever you want to call it at that time. And I'm teaching a class right now on the American War in Vietnam. And it's a perfectly timed course because it coincides with the 50th anniversary. The last day of my class is April 30th. And I teach, you know, to the students, besides the history of the war and so on, some principles to think about in terms of memory, in terms of dealing with the past, in terms of how we approach the past in order to deal with the present. And to me, so much of the Southern Vietnamese American commemorations of April 30th, obviously, are very much past oriented, but not present or future oriented. And it's fine. I think people need to commemorate. If we don't remember ourselves as Vietnamese Americans, who will? So I'm not opposed to anybody carrying out April 30th celebrations. But of course, I don't need to participate in them. Instead, when I talk about anything related to Vietnam and the Vietnam War nowadays, it's much more in terms of its relationship, their relationship to current operations of power. So, you know, what have we learned from the Vietnam War as Americans? I mean, the idea that the Vietnam War is a bad war is a fading idea at this point. You know, it's not even a part of popular cultural memory. All my students are born after 9/11. Most of them have never even seen a Vietnam War movie. This is ancient history to them. So instead, the institutional memory of the American War in Vietnam carried out by the Pentagon, Department of Defense, American presidents, and so on, has been really to retool the Vietnam War for present purposes. That's what I'm concerned about, you know. And if you know, anybody wants to talk about the current Vietnamese nation state and its problems, I'm happy to talk about that too. There was just a news came out. Vietnam is buying spy satellites from Israel, for example. And a lot of pro-Palestinian people are like, this is terrible. We got to boycott Vietnam. They've forgotten their revolutionary history. That's exactly right. That's what we should be talking about. I don't care that Vietnam is a communist country or run by a communist government. You know, I care much more about what Vietnam is doing to its people and what Vietnam is doing in terms of being a nation state, betraying its revolutionary ideas. And for those people who are anti-communist or pro-communist, wherever they stand, there's plenty to critique Vietnam for in terms of all those kinds of issues versus simply what happened on April 30th.
If we didn't have voices like yours, we would, I mean, I speak for myself. If I didn't have you to kind of come and share your ideas, I think that, you know, we'd be leaning very one-sided. But I think about what you say all the time. If you're not pissing off both sides of the equation, you might not be doing your job right. I think that's to paraphrase you grossly.
You've said that before.
Yeah. Nothing to add to that, Ken.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I think a writer's job, a certain kind of writer's job, is to be disagreeable, is to make people uncomfortable, whether it's on a political issue or social issue, or whether it's through the art itself. You know, I mean, there's a function for the writer to be an entertainer too. Sometimes I like to fulfill that, but kind of art and politics I'm interested in are usually the kinds that produce friction. And some people don't like friction, and some people do like friction, but we have to imagine that friction also produces pleasure too.
Yeah. Fit, thank you so much. I know you're so busy, and I know you are going right back to class right now. And thank you so much for giving me this time. And it really helps resolve some of the questions I've had, and gives me more pep in my step. Thank you very much, Fit.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.